Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
I have fantastic news, everybody. My literary masterpiece, Life of the Party, which you have not read yet, will now be available in audiobook form. The Hopeblazer called and said he thought it was a great idea because the pre-sales are going so well. So if you haven't already, please go to burtburtburt.com and pre-order your copy of Life of the Party. Pre-orders determine how well a book does overall, and if you tweet me a copy of your pre-order, I will follow you, I will favorite you, I will do your podcast, I will buy you a beer. Ask anyone in Edmonton or in Pittsburgh. I'm still on tour. Nashtucket, Nashmantucket, Tampa, Irvine, Philly, Des Moines, Dayton, Phoenix. My show Trip Flip airs every Wednesday night on Travel Channel at 9 p.m. with a new episode. Today's guest, my old manager and host of the podcast, The Industry Standard, Barry Katz.
This is the Birdcast.
9, 10, 11, 12. That unmistakable voice, that probably the most, I would say you have the most imitated voice in the industry?
It appears that way.
There's a statement to a person when you see that person, if you can't help but tell the story about them and do the imitation of them.
Do you do a good impression of me?
I do the best in the business because I know you.
Really?
Yeah, and so my impression...
So tell me one story that you tell somebody like in a yard somewhere that involves me where you do my voice.
It only works with comics. And because it's... Oh, sorry, that's a...
Can you hear this here? I'm on this couch in a man cave, and I'm leaning against something. I notice this noise that keeps making, like, it's interrupting the podcast. I look over. There's a Ziploc bag with some Old Spice palm tree, sunshine, whatever smell, a clippers to keep his genitals groomed, and an electric toothbrush with no top. With Oral-B toothpaste, and that's what I'm rubbing up against as I go here. Okay,
my impression of you is deeper than say like an Elon Gould, right? Is that saying?
Yeah, we can call him Gould for now. He can be non-Jewish for this podcast.
So now you can't. Don't be Barry in this, because my impression is I need a participant. Okay, you be me. All right.
Okay, I've never tried to do another dialect other than myself. So I'll just do somebody that I think I am.
This is why my impression's the best. Because
why can't you just do both characters?
Okay. I'll do both characters. So I'll be me and this is Barry. So Barry would say we run into he goes, "Hey Papa, how are you doing this weekend?" I said, "Good." And you just sit and nod your head. And then what happens to me is I go, pretty good. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I drank too much. Okay. I took a Xanax to sleep one night, and I drank on the Xanax, and I probably shouldn't have done that. All right. So what you would do was, my impression of you entails not speaking at all, because your mantra was to, you could get information out of me that I wouldn't tell a fucking soul. Because you wouldn't reply back, and you knew I would talk. I don't even know if you did this on purpose, but so it was like I just would divulge. By the end, I'm like, "And I killed a hooker, okay? I killed a hooker. Did you get it? Did you get it all? Are you happy? What happened with the audition?" It was the first thing you ever told me when I first met you, guys in the man cave, Barry Katz.
Oh, what an honor,
Barry Katz, the guy who single-handedly is probably the reason I'm working today. No questions asked. I started at his comedy club. David J. Nash, who was on your podcast, Industry Standard, by the way, which is an amazing fucking podcast. I'm being dead serious. You are an insanely, acutely wise interviewer.
Thanks, man.
I listened to Eric Tenenbaum.
Thanks, man.
I listened to the guy that ran HBO.
Chris Albrecht.
Chris Albrecht was amazing. I didn't know his trajectory in his career. Barry's podcast is basically talks to people who are the decision makers in Hollywood or the people that make a difference in Hollywood, and he talks about what is important in Hollywood, what is it is. If you're at all interested in Hollywood, you don't even need to recognize the name because that is how Hollywood works. The names you don't know are the decision makers, and you can listen from beginning to end, and you learn so fucking much. It is amazing.
It's thank you so much. You know, when I we'll talk about that thing that you wanted to talk about because I want to talk about that too. It's what's amazing about it is the fact that when I started it, and I guess I can share this with you.
Yeah.
I managed you when you first started.
Yeah.
And one of the things about managing someone that's so exciting is that there's a checklist of goals that a person has as an artist. When you're a young artist, like you just want to be a regular at the Comedy Cellar or the Boston or
it's
wherever.
It's amazing how you don't see past that in this business.
Yeah, you just want.
Because if you did, you may not get into this business.
Yeah, you just want to be somebody who's like maybe does a set on a late night show or something of that nature.
That was a big goal of the majority of guys starting.
So the goals aren't that great. But the fact is, when you're a manager and you with your talent and their talent, you accomplish goals. Like for Bert and I, one of the most amazing things and one of the things on his list was that he wanted to have a development deal for his own television show, which was obviously a number one goal, but way off in the distance. But unbelievably, the way we worked, and we'll tell that story probably later, is that literally, like within a couple of months after meeting him, we're in a car with Will Smith driving the pitch meetings.
Driving over Beverly Glen.
Yeah.
And I remember you going, so this is the easiest way to get to the valley from Beverly Hills. And I was like, I just want to know. I knew so little about anything that I was like, wait, we're going to Beverly Hills?
Yeah. And so what I was saying about the podcast is the fact that when you work with somebody with my talent and their talent and something happens, it's incredible. But when you go home at the end of the day, you realize that you've only been able to inspire and help one person. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to start the podcast badly a couple of years ago, but then I thought to myself something that I tell artists not to worry about, which is I was worried what people would think. And
so
I didn't do it, and then I said, fuck it, I'm going to do it.
That's so funny, because your best, Barry has some amazing traits. One of them, and I'll probably mention all of them throughout this podcast, one of them is your advice to comics is some of the advice you've given me. And one of the advice you gave me is to ignore what people think. I remember you said it so clearly. I did a showcase, and I bombed. And you said to me, and I was so freaked out, I called you, and I was like, Barry, I'm so freaked out. What are these people thinking? And he goes, you go, let me tell you something, Papa. They're not thinking about you. I think you're highly overestimating how much people think about you. And I went, really? He goes, what have you been thinking about all day? I go, me? And he goes, them too.
It's true.
It's true. You get so obsessed about what people think about you, and you realize, I'm thinking about me. They're thinking about them.
That's
no one's
right.
thinking about me.
That's right. And so I realized I was being stupid, and I took my own, you know, they say those who can't manage. And so then I started, I said, I'm going to do this, and I want to talk to the, because no other manager was doing it, no other producer was doing it, so that says something like, hey, there's a reason why they're not doing it. So then I thought, well, I only want to do it if I could talk to these network presidents and studio executives or people who really hadn't done that many podcasts before. Then I realized when I made the commitment, I still had to call these people.
That's the worst.
And I have to ask them to do it. And the first person I called was Doug Herzog, who's the...
Herzog was the first pilot we sold to Fox with Will Smith.
That's right.
And Doug Herzog was in the room. And I remember very candidly, he was like, I'll buy it. Like, I don't think we even said anything.
No.
He was like, I'll buy it.
No, he felt he's a special man, and now he's the chairman of the Viacom Entertainment Group, which is the president of Comedy Central, TV Land, Spike, like seven networks. And then once he said yes, it's like anything else, like when you're trying to do something, if you're trying to negotiate a deal, let's say your deal with Travel Channel, you have another offer on the table, there's other people who do it. And slowly, you know, I got people like, Chris Albrecht, and Chris Albrecht was interesting because Chris Albrecht had a lot of things going on, and I called him up, and it's interesting what you said about the tact of not saying anything, because I just, when you said that, I really wasn't cognizant that I do it, but now you reminded me. When I called Chris Albrecht to do the podcast, he said, "Barry, obviously I can't do any podcast. I can't do any interviews. I turned down the New York Times. I turned down the Time Mag. I'm not going to do any interviews. I'm sorry. I can't do it." And at that moment, I did something that I guess I hadn't done in a while. I didn't say anything. And there were 5 seconds, 7 seconds, 8 seconds, 10 seconds. Still didn't say anything. And all of a sudden, on the other end of the phone, he said, "All right, Barry, I'll do the fucking podcast." You know? And he came and he did it. And all these people, they have like tight time frames. They have like an hour, but then they always, you give them the hour sign and they always stay. I just did Dr. Phil. Dr. Phil has never done a podcast. And people don't know this. He runs this whole Stage 29, which is he has all the doctors and the tests and the Dr. Phil. But he's also has a great story that he never tells. And I was after him for 9 months. It took me 9 months to get him. I mean, I would call him. I called him, and when he was in Italy, I called him. And just, I guess I just probably wore him down. And,
yeah.
And at the end of the podcast, he divulged so many things about his life, that he was homeless and lived in a car with his alcoholic father when he was a teenager, that
Holy
his
shit.
Two sisters married when they were 14. He said that he was a millionaire before he got on Oprah, and he was involved with her when she was sued by the meat industry in Texas, and he convinced her to go through with it. All of her lawyers said settle, and he said, "Oprah, do not settle. There will be a long line to the Oprah Sue Club if you settle. Fight them." But anyway, the point being is that, and at the end of the podcast, he's like, I just want to know, how did you get me here? Why am I here? How did you get all this information out of it? It was kind of comical.
Yeah.
But by doing this, you start and you do these podcasts like yours or whatever, and then people give you the metrics, and then you realize that 2 million people download things that you're on, and you realize you're getting letters from all over the world, and not just people in entertainment. People are like, "Hey, I work in this law firm in a cubicle, and now I know what I have to do to get to the next level. I have to create a problem." Like when I interviewed Walter Newman, it was fascinating.
Who's Walter Newman?
Walter Newman was an assistant at Comedy Central for 3 years, wallowing in defeat as an assistant in a cubicle. And he would work hard every night, and I'll tell you this quick story. So he's in the cubicle.
By the way, that's an oxymoron with Barry.
Oh, sorry. it might not be a quick story.
So he was wallowing in the cubicle.
And one night he tells a story, I'm paraphrasing, but of how he finally was going to get some action. He was working so hard. This girl called him up, get together, hook up, whatever. And then she cancels at the last minute. It's a Friday night. And he's like, fuck it. I'll just stay at work and search the internet for more content, more original content from people out there who aren't getting their due.
Yeah.
And he found this group called Mail Order Comedy. And he thought to himself, as he put the stuff on DVDs, he thought, should I just put this on my boss's desk? Or should I make a post and make a DVD and put it on every single executive's
desk? That's a fucking brilliant move.
So he put it on his boss's desk. He put it on every boss's desk, every executive's desk. And they all watched it. They talked about it in that meeting they have every week to talk about television shows. And that television show is Workaholics. And so after that went on the air, Walter Newman was no longer an assistant, and Walter Newman was getting offers from everywhere, and now he's the director of comedy development at Adult Swim.
Holy shit, that's a great story.
But it's true of anything. Doug Herzog on Comedy Central, he talked about Debbie Liebling, who was a lower level executive, and he talked about the story where he was walking through the hallways or something, and she tapped him on the shoulder. He said, "Can I show you something, Doug?" And he's like, "Sure." And they went in the conference room, and she took out a VHS tape. That's how long ago it was. And she popped in a 2-minute animated tape, the South Park Christmas card, that they had sent out to 1,000 people by VHS tape. And he watched it, and he's like, "Play it again." She played it again. He says, "Play it again." Play it again. He said, "Listen. And he said this on the pod. Listen, true to my form, I was wrong about this. I said, listen, we can't put this on the air, but let's bring these guys in here and do a deal.
Yeah.
But he ended up putting it on the air. The show's made $1 billion, and Debbie Liebling wasn't a lower-level executive anymore. So people all over the world who listen to the podcast, they don't have to be in entertainment. You could be working at McDonald's and figure out how to get to the next level, or working at a law firm or a medical facility or anywhere you're working. It's all about how do you deal with the defeats, the challenges, but it's the entertainment business as the genre and the backdrop. Like news radio. It wasn't about the place where they were. It was about the journeys of each character and how they went. So that's what I wanted to do with it. And the fact that you've listened to some,
I'll tell you what happened.
I'm like completely humbled by it. I'm like,
I got the first one. Was Doug Herzog, and I listened to that on a ride to Brea.
Now, keep in mind, just so your audience knows, I feel like a magician doing a trick here. I never told you to listen to it, did I?
No. No, someone told me, Barry has a podcast, and I went, in my head, I was like, I wonder what Barry's talking about. And then I saw it was industry standard. Now, I am grossly obsessed with how this industry works, mostly because I'm on the other side of the fence and there's hedges up. So I can never really see how the sausage is made on the other side. So to be able to see behind that curtain is fascinating. I mean, majority of comics are like, how do I sell a show? Well, once you sell a show, you're like, okay, how do I start producing my own shows? Then once you do that, you're like, all right, how do I start a production company where I can get my other friend shows? And it's like, so I listened to the one with Herzog, and then I was on the road. I just did a deal with I'd just gone out and sold a show with Eric Tannenbaum. And we sold it to three.
An amazing man.
We sold it to three networks. Our pitch was fantastic, and there was a bidding war. And Eric's like, this is the best situation to be in. And I was like, fuck yes. And I'm sitting in a hotel room. We just took off to go do Travel Channel. Sitting in a hotel room thinking, my shit is unstoppable right now. I am fucking on fire. And I'm like, B-man, you're patting yourself on the back. And I look and I see your podcast. It has an Eric Tannenbaum on it. And I go, you know what? Let me get to know the guy I'm working with. Turns out I didn't sell a show to three networks. Eric Tannenbaum sold a show to three networks. Apparently he is the Moses of television. And I literally was humbled in my bed, and I was like, I'm so honored to be working with Eric. Thank you so much, Eric, for getting me into these rooms. Thank you for sitting by me and saying, I want to work with him. Because they were like, well, we want to work with Eric. Whoever Eric wants to work with is who we want to work with. And I was like, it's interesting. Humility is such a valuable trait to have in this business, and hubris and ego can tear you down so fucking quickly. And I literally listened to that whole podcast and was like, god damn it, here I am. I've been sitting in a room with Eric, a handful of times, maybe 10 times, talking about me. Like, how come I didn't listen to him? It's my problem is not listening. David Steinberg and I worked together on something, and David said, I really find you interesting, Bert. We should do a lunch and maybe figure out a project. I was like, great. So I go to lunch with him. I didn't let him talk about him at all. I talked about me. Turns out David Steinberg is a fucking trailblazer in comedy. He is the head of the TM movement in Beverly Hills, and it is everything I need in life. David Steinberg has the key to. And I was like, if I had let him talk, I would fucking be so much richer of a person. And it's one of the traits you do have is you do let people talk. You're a good interviewer on these podcasts. And you bring it back. You bring it back to the thing that when the guy says something interesting and then goes on a tangent, you bring it back to that thing. I don't do that. I change subjects. And people are like, he was about to tell you what it was like to work with Leonardo DiCaprio when you cut him off. So
I'm going to tell you that I think, and I've rarely used this term, I think you're wrong about something.
About what?
And if Eric Tannenbaum were here, he'd tell you the same thing. Eric is a facilitator. He's a master facilitator. He's a master executive and he's like a great referee in an NBA finals game. When the game's there and the spotlight's on, he disappears. You don't really see him, but his presence is there, keeping the game moving and keeping the game one of the greatest games you'll ever see in your life. That's what he does. His goal is to work with great talent and get the fuck out of the way. And I will share this with you where you're wrong, very wrong. I've gone out with Eric Tannenbaum many times. I've sold shows with Eric Tannenbaum. I've had bidding wars with Eric Tannenbaum. But in the past 2 years or year, I went out with a show, a big show, a big package, and I'm not insulting you, with big people that are like iconic people that I didn't even know I had the ability to be around and package a show with. And we went everywhere, and we did not sell that show. And you sold your show, somebody at a much lower level than these people. And I'm talking about people that are household names above anybody that we ever think of. But you did it because you went in the room and sold it, and you sold yourself and painted the picture for those executives. So it was a no-brainer. So that when the door closed, they said, we have to be in business with this person. And there's many times you go on pitches and you're not aware of this because you're not in these rooms. Sometimes the people who don't get the things done are the people who you expect to get the things done. And sometimes the people that don't. There's a reason why Russell Wilson is holding a championship trophy and a guy who has 15 years more experience than him isn't. Okay? It happens that way. Sometimes people go in the rooms and they can do something really special. And then there's the person who has the sense of entitlement that doesn't necessarily go in there with as much hunger. So Eric, yes, Eric can get shit done. He can sell shows. But keep in mind, if I were to speak to Eric and if he were right here, and I would say, tell me all the shows you're executive producing that are on the air right now. And he'd say, 2 and a Half Men. Tell me what other shows you have that you're executive producing that are on the air right now. 2 and a Half Men. Because it's fucking hard out there.
He's
executive producing, the second or third longest running show in history. He's probably, like, you know, putting money into piles on piles of other piles of other piles.
Yeah.
And then, amazingly successful man.
A fascinating career.
But the fact is that out of all the shows he's worked on for the last 12 years, he has one on the air. That lets you know how tough the television business is. And if he has another one on the air this season, my apologies, Eric, but I'm just saying from what I know from the last time we were together. So your show had a bidding war for three things. One person paid the price. Now you got to sit down and you got to figure out what showrunner writer you're going to write this thing with, which is the next step.
Oh, it's the entire process of creating television. And I've gone through, I went through two of them with you, and it is so enjoyable to get the deal, but development is, as you start developing, it's like being in a relationship and you can see telltale signs of it going south. And you're like, uh-oh, this doesn't seem good. Like you said, well, the first time I got my deal, you're like, this is great. The stars aligned. But realize the planets now don't need to align. And the stars need to stay in the same place they were in order for the show to get on the air.
Think about it, for your audience to think about this. Will Smith is walking into rooms to do a television show. If Will Smith can't get a fucking show on the air, at least get a pilot made.
Yeah.
What does that tell you about the television? Eddie Murphy had a pilot last year with Brandon T. Jackson. Eddie Murphy. And it didn't get on the air. Yet Whitney got picked up for a second season or Up All Night or think Eddie. I'm not, this is no disrespect to Up All Night and Lorne Michaels or whatever, but Eddie Murphy.
Yeah,
it's like this is the thing. If Whitney were right here, she'd be like, "I got picked up and Eddie Murphy didn't."
Yeah,
that's what's crazy about this business, and that's what tells you it's all about the content and the personality. All these people are looking for is somebody who makes them feel safe and who they know America will love and rally around. And sometimes the shows that don't work, I'm not talking about dramas or dramedies.
Yeah.
I'm talking about comedies. If you don't have huggable and lovable characters in those shows, you're in deep shit. And you can point to every single show on the air that has not been a juggernaut, even if they're still on, and you'll find characters that are not huggable and lovable. on the show Whitney, for instance, it went 2 years, 40 or 44 episodes, which is a massive accomplishment.
That's like this business. That's like getting to the Olympic trials and losing by 0.2 seconds.
Yeah, it's like that kind of thing. But the fact is, if you analyzed all the characters and you broke all the characters down in the show, there's not one character in the show that's the kind of character like how as lovable as like an Ellen or like a Michael Richards,
Kevin James,
or a Kevin James. Like, you know, America loves the fat guy.
Yeah.
So it's like, not that he's fat anymore, but you know what I'm saying? So those are the kind of characters that you have. And even in 30 Rock, you know, which was a show that was very successful, won many Emmy Awards, but I think even Tina Fey, if she were listening, would say, God, I wish the ratings were bigger and stronger, and how come 2.5 Men gets 20 million people and we get 6 or 5 million?
Yeah.
But the point being is, if you analyze all the characters on the show, none of them are like that you want to run up to and you want to hug. They're all borderline characters where they're not unlovable, but they're not like 100% lovable. And I always say, in terms of formulas and shows and things, you know, people are always trying to do something new. But if you analyze the way television is, even something like 30 Rock, if you are a historian, 30 Rock is, I love the show. I mean, I love it. But if you analyze it, it's just the Mary Tyler Moore show. Tina Fey is Mary.
Oh, yeah.
Alec Baldwin is Lou Grant, and Tracy Morgan is Ted Knight. It's just the,
I never looked at it that way.
But, you know, there's a lot of things that aren't necessarily new in comedy. It's like, for instance, you know, David Copperfield would be the first one to tell you that you have to study the people before you. Candid Camera, you know, Candid Camera is the lifeline to shows like Punk'd or, you know, Girls Behaving Badly or all these things. It's like,
yeah.
It's the formula that you, and then you adjust the formula and you make it your own. And when you do your show, you're going to notice that there's formulas and characters that you have on your show that are going to have similarities to certain things that have been in the past. Yes, there's shows that...
Now, do you say to embrace those similarities so that they're more familiar to America? Or do you say simply recognize them and do your own thing?
You got
to
recognize them and embrace them and do your own thing. And it's like, so
this is what it's like being managed by Barry, everybody.
So give me an example. Like, there's very few things that have never been done before in half-hour comedy. I'll give you an example of one thing that's never been done before since. Bob Newhart's show, I think it was called Newhart, Daryl, and Daryl. Okay, there's never been a show that had three brothers that were named the same. There's no formula in television ever that ever had that in it. Now, you could try to analyze every show in the world, and it's never happened.
Yeah.
So there are things that happen in many shows that have never been done before and are wonderful techniques. Like, for instance, you say DJ Nash. He's been trying to get a show about his own life on forever because he grew up, his father was blind. Finally, there's a sitcom.
Growing Up Fisher.
Yeah, with a blind father on the thing. Never been done before that I know of on television in a half-hour comedy.
Yeah. I was in a pilot with him with a blind father.
That's right.
That was the
first pilot we did. And that's I want to talk about that, too, because that was something that really, that's really an important thing for your audience to hear about that. But so the fact is that, yes, there's going to be characters like the father who have characteristics like that blind father, but the actual technique of how it is, and it's a real technique because it's real life, is something that America hasn't seen before.
Mm-hmm.
And the key is to make it funny without America going, ugh. And that's why it's been so hard for him to get on the air, and he's been trying for 10 years to get on the air, and it's finally on the air and doing well. And so every show you want to do, like, for instance, Mary Tyler Moore, hello, this is Carlton, your doorman. You never saw Carlton the doorman. Never been done in any sitcom before that, Carlton your doorman. Home Improvement. Took a little bit of that with the neighbor who you could only see with the eyes down. That was their Carlton your doorman.
Yeah.
And it worked. And so these things are things that you have to think about as you go when you're doing things. But the bottom line is, if you have a great story and you create holy shit moments, Bert, you're
holy shit
win.
Moments. There are phrases you're going to get from Barry that will stay in your head for the rest of your life. Holy shit moments is something Barry looks for in talent. I'll never forget. I had a manager. I worked with Barry. What happens sometimes is a guy like Barry will start a company and he will manage all the clients. And then the list will become so big, he'll have his assistants then grow to managers, and then they will start managing clients. And there was a guy, Vincent Nastri, who I worked with. I worked with Barry, and then Vincent took care of me. And if it was anything big, Barry would step in and tell you the law. Like, I remember, and I don't like talking about this at all. And I don't want this to be a part of my fucking... Anyway, let me just tell the story.
You can talk about anything you want.
I know,
nothing is off limits here.
So, when Van Wilder came out, Vincent and I think Andy Cohen or Scott Simpson, I think it was just Vincent really, wanted to sue. And he was really adamant. They've taken it. It is the script they were developing. And he was very adamant. And I remember you got on the phone. You said like 10 words. You said, "Let me tell you something, Papa. There's two types of people in this business, people who sue and people who work. Which one do you want to be?" And you hung up, and I went, "We're not suing. Fuck it. I don't give a shit. That's not my story. I don't care." At the time, I was working, and I was like, great, now, the other one. And by the way, Vincent, I know you're listening to this, and I love you, and we both love you with all our hearts. But the other one was, this is the greatest advice I've ever fucking gotten. And I know Judy's also listening to this, my current manager. And Judy, you give me great advice also all the time. But I'm just saying this, I'll never forget it. I went into CBS. I had a deal at CBS. It was a year deal. And they developed a sitcom around me. David J had a deal at the same time. And in a deal, you can also then audition to be in other sitcoms. If they choose not to make yours, they can then plug you into another sitcom they
have. Yeah, just so to clarify for your audience, when you do a development deal, normally what they try to lock into the deal for young talent or people that haven't been doing that long, and probably they try to do it now for established talent, is while they're developing for you, if things aren't going the way they want them to, they can present you with three different shows to be cast into or test for to get.
Yeah.
If you pass on one, that's cool. If you pass on the second one, that's cool. If you pass on the third one, you got to give the money back.
Yeah.
And so that's the way normally it works. Sometimes it's less.
And I had auditioned for David J. Nash. I guess he's just called David J. Nash now?
He was David J. then. Now he's DJ Nash.
DJ Nash. So I auditioned for DJ's part. And he had written the part specifically for me. That's how smart David J was, is that he knew they were making a sitcom about me, and he thought, well, if I make a sitcom about me and Bert, just base it on Bert and his buddy Carl, then why wouldn't they make mine and put both of us in it? And so I auditioned, and the network decided they didn't want to go with me. And Vincent was like fucking so angry, and he was like, Barry, you got to call him and just let him test.
This was a big moment for me.
And you called and you said, guys, you're already paying him. Who cares? Let him test. And they were like, no. And you fought for it, and you got me to test, and you told me.
I fought long and hard for that.
You told me at Yamashiro, me, you, and Vincent, I can tell you where we were sitting. I love small details. It's when you're attached to the truth in your life, you remember the small details. I can tell you where we're sitting. I can tell you where I was sitting. I can tell you where you were sitting. And I told you, fuck it, Barry. I don't want to test. If they don't want me, I don't want them. And you said, let me tell you a story about Hideo Nomo. Do you remember this story?
Keep going.
You said, Hideo Nomo played for the Dodgers, and he was amazing, Papa. He was crazy. First some year, he killed it. Second year, not so good. Third year, he drops off entirely, and they don't want him anymore. So they trade him to Boston. No one expected anything out of Hideo Nomo. His first game in Boston, what does he do? He throws a no-fucking-hitter. Do you know why? Because no one was expecting it. Be Hideo Nomo. And I fucking had tears in my eyes. And I fucking was like, I'm Hideo Nomo. I rolled into that fucking audition.
audition, and I murdered it. I murdered the best audition I've ever had in my life because I thought to myself, Amadeo Nomo, right now this is the Boston fans going, who the fuck's this Asian guy? And I walked in, and I ripped it in Fox, and I walked in, and I'll never forget, I walked in, and I was so confident going, I just threw 8 innings in Fox. All I got to do is close out at CBS because they already had the deal. And I walked in. Les Moonves was in the front row. David J was standing on up
Les
front.
Les Moonves, by the way, the most powerful person probably in the business.
And I walked in, and I knew all the ladies in the back were all, by the way, they're still the same ladies that are running CBS.
And just so you know, not to interrupt, but I am, there's a few things that happen when you go in these tests. You're in the meeting with all the executives that have been involved in the project, the executive producers of the television show, the star of the television show, the creator, the studio executives, the one who are deficiting the show, and I forget who was deficiting that show.
Fox.
So it was Fox Studios, not the network. So you have all the...
Oh, no, I think his was CBS Productions, maybe.
Or maybe it was CBS Productions. Whatever it was, you have all these people in the room, but there's one person who makes the decision, and that's the president of the network, and that's Les Moonves. It doesn't matter if there's 30 people in the room and 29 people want the other guy. If Les Moonves wants you, you have the gig. And that's how it worked with him. And he was an actor early on. He knew acting, and he chooses every single person. This is what's weird, again, for your audience that you should know about this business. Normally, you only have to fool people 4 times as an actor for 5 minutes, and you could be on television for 7 fucking years. This is how it normally works. You go, and your manager agent sends you an audition, and you go to the audition with the casting director, with a person reading the script like they're functionally disabled, an intern with a camera that's like, state your name, please. Wait a second, I didn't take the cap off. And they do it, and you do your thing, and you do well. Then you go to the next step, was your casting director and the executive producers and the star of the show. You go there, you audition for 5 minutes. If they love you, then you get the test.
Oh, look who it is. Lorenzo. Remember Lorenzo?
Yeah, he looks like he's lost weight.
Yeah, he's doing CrossFit.
Unbelievable.
So keep going.
So then what happens is that you go in and you go for this, you test, you write out a contract. It's negotiated for 6 or 7 years because you don't want to go into the test with the studio and not have that with them. And they say, oh, well, we want you. And then you say, hey, fuck it, I want more money. They make you sign a contract that has your rate for the pilot and rate for the series if it goes with every subsequent year or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So then you go in for the test at the studio. If they like you, you move on to the network. You go do that 5 minutes. They like you. You got the gig.
Yep.
But in your case, which was amazing, you were like an NFL team with a bye, okay? So you didn't have to go to the casting director. You didn't have to go to the executive producer and the casting director. You just went straight to the studio and the network. You only had to win twice.
I only had to win twice. And the one hard one, I think, was the studio. And when I went into the network, it was almost like I felt like I couldn't lose because I knew all the women who ran the network, and all Julie, Wendy
Trilling, Julie Pernworth, Edie Mendoza,
and so I knew all them, and they were on my team. But Les was sitting front and center in the very first row, and I had never met him. And I walked in, David J is standing up front, and I remember the other thing you said is you are a comedian, use that to your advantage. Make a joke. When you go in there, lighten the mood.
It's so true, everybody. If you're listening to this, and what's hard is for actors and actresses who aren't comedians and aren't in that world, it's difficult because you can't go in. You just got to go in and say you're ready because you're not confident you can make that lighthearted thing. But it works. You know, anything comedic works. I remember the first time I had every meeting you can.
There's a great story you have about Jeff Ross, where Jeff Ross went in and said, made a joke that you told me that night, and you were like, "This is what Jeff Ross did," and it killed, and he got the part. And I forget what the joke was, but I remember thinking
it's like these people go in and they do. Sometimes if you're a comedian and you're going to test for something, what I like to have somebody prepare is I would like to have them prepare like 4 or 5 opening lines. Because what can happen sometimes, you go to the studio test, you do it, and you tell your line, you make your funny line, you go and do it. And sometimes they hold you outside and they bring you back in again to do something a little bit differently. They say, listen, could you be a little angrier this time? And so I have people prepare a different line for how many times they could possibly go in and do it. So people are saying, my God, he came up with another improv line there. He came up with another improv there. And guys like who it's worked really well for recently, guys who are comedians, I'm trying to think, like Dan a Dude. You know, he got Super Fun Night, and he went in and he had a different line for everything and made it work, and it worked for him. And it works for you because you're funny and whatever.
Mine worked in the sense that I was so uncaged at the time that I was very me in the moment. I was very honest. And so I walked in, and Les Moonves was sitting in the front row, and he goes, "Hello, Bert. Good to see you again." And I was like, "I don't think we've ever met." And he goes, "We haven't?" And I said, "I would definitely remember that hair." And and the room starts laughing.
And see what you did? Now, I just want to share what you did right there. This is so great. See, the thing is that as a comedian, you have to take risks.
You have
to take risks. And so you have a guy who literally is God in that room.
Yes.
To those people. Those people in that room walk on eggshells around this guy. Okay? So I remember similarly with Whitney, we were on a couch ready to pitch NBC. And the guy who we were pitching to, Jeff Engel, this tall, blonde, good-looking guy, goes by the couch. He says, "Oh, Whitney, I'm sorry, I'm a little bit late. Just let me get settled, and I'll bring you in for the pitch for Whitney." You know what I mean? And she stands up, gets right 6 inches from his face, and Whitney has this thing where she can look at you, and
she's uber sexual,
this very sensual but powerful way about her.
Yeah,
she stands up in her high heels, and she's eye to eye with him, sort of looking up at him. And she shakes his hand. She's holding his hand. And she looks at him, and the first thing she says is, "My God, look at you. You're like a member of Hitler's master race." And I knew right then and there that show was sold.
Whitney
and so when you said that about Les Moonves' hair, the people in that room knew right then and there, unless you took a shit on the floor, you were getting that gig.
Oh, I want to say, and then he goes, "Well, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thank you. And I said, "I'm shocked you're not an actor. You're gorgeous." And he started laughing, and I didn't know that he had been an actor. And then he goes, "Well, it's good to finally meet you, Bert." And he starts loosening up. And I go, "Have you met David J?" And he goes, and DJ's silent. I go, "DJ, have you met Les?" And he goes, "Not yet." I go, "Les, this is DJ." He goes, "Hello, David. Nice to meet you." And David goes, "Very nice to meet you. I like your hair as well." And then I go, "Should we start this?" And he's like, "Okay." And both DJ and I probably sucked a dick in that room. But Les Moonves was like, "Those are the guys."
That's
and he
right.
plugged us in.
And, you know, just to share with you here and to your fans listening, it's like, as a manager, managing you at that point in time in my life was probably one of the highlights of my life as a manager that I'll always remember. And that, to me, like, there's things about managing that are wonderful. They're exciting. Just like there's things about being a performer, a musician, a magician, a comedian, whatever, that are really exciting. But there's other parts of the business that, you know, systematically beat you down. Like what we're in now, pilot season or the end of pilot season. There's no actor or actress or comedian or whatever or manager or agent that loves pilot season, because the fact is that it's like what Jerry Maguire would say, it's a pride swallowing thing. You're fighting to get your artists in the room when no one cares, no one needs anybody. There's like such a glut of everybody, and there's only a number of slots. And I'm grateful that this pilot season I probably had like 10 people test for things. But what I'm saying is that for me, it's not fun. There's nothing fun, you know, and I feel like, and maybe it's me saying this and it's not meant as a sense of entitlement. It's just whenever you're doing something, you want to have more control over things. And as an artist, you're trying to go in and you're going in and you know there's 100, 200 people that want to take you out. You know you're going into the room with the casting directors, and you know if you weren't even there, they wouldn't even give a shit.
Yeah.
So everybody has to make their mark, and it's like the Amazing Race if the Amazing Race had like 200 contestants.
Yeah.
And it's not just managers and agents. It's actors, actresses, comedians, and just trying to win the race because there's only one spot for you. There can be only one winner, except if it's a sketch show. You could be like the fourth best guy and get a sketch show. But
yeah.
So these are things that, and going back to the podcast, that, you know, I don't really enjoy as much as I used to anymore, but I do it, and I do it well. I know I do it well, but I just don't, just like there's things that you do really well that you don't enjoy as much. And so, but getting back to, you know, your moment there when I was representing you, you telling those stories about how we did it. And I say we because when I met Bert at my comedy club, and he was like helping me with the door at the comedy club for stage time. And I've always been the kind of person, and I don't know what this is about him, and you can never quantify it in the court of law. I don't know why I feel these things from certain artists, that I just know something's going to happen. Bert hadn't even been on stage. I don't think Bert had been on stage 20 times in his life, maybe 50.
Maybe about 27.
And so I wanted to represent him, and he was doing the door, and he'd only been on stage 50 times. But I saw something in him that I believed where he could get to the next level. And I brought people to see him, even though he'd only been doing comedy 50 times.
David Tochterman,
who was working with Will Smith at the time. He's now an agent at Innovative.
Is he really?
Yeah. And I didn't tell David you'd only been on stage 50 times.
Yeah.
But there was something about you that I loved, that I believed in. I was worried about you in certain cases, but I believed in you, and I knew that you were malleable. I knew you would listen, and I knew you would give it everything that you had. And when those things happened, when you're a manager, what happens is it's the same as an artist. The artist, people are looking at when that happened with Bert, and he got that development deal, and he was traveling around with Will Smith. All those comedians in New York that were so friendly to him and so nice and so wonderful. Bert, come on. You want to do some stage time, whatever, do whatever. Not so nice anymore after that.
I remember you told me, you said, get information, do not give information.
That's right. Lou Wasserman, long old-time agents, used to say that, yeah.
He said, do not tell anyone about this deal. Do not bring it up to anyone.
But it didn't matter because comedians are like grandmothers, and they found out in a hurry.
Yeah, and Patrice O'Neill was the first one.
And they started treating Bert not well because they were jealous and they were unhappy and they thought it wasn't his time. And other managers as well have always, I don't want to say every manager, but a lot of managers have always looked at me not like if they were not with love and affection, but like, what the fuck, you know, he's got four people on SNL and he doesn't even, who is this guy? What's happening? Or how did Bert get this deal with Will Smith, or what happened? And I've always been the kind of guy who, I've always felt I could always make it happen. You just give me something. Give me something. And if I put my attention to it, I can make it happen. But as I said to you before the podcast, one of the hardest things, it's not, as they say, it's not getting there, it's staying there and helping artists to continually reevaluate and make changes and do things. And that's one of the things that you should be very proud of your present manager, Judy Brown, because Judy's doing something that I wasn't able to do for you. And I don't get me wrong, I was a great manager with you and we accomplished.
I have a great analogy about your career.
Okay.
I have a great analogy about your career. But yes, Judy, yes. So Judy,
I
want to
finish with Judy because I think that the fact is that when I was doing my stuff and I was growing and I was doing what I was doing, trying to expand, I was trying to help inspire young managers to be better and to take the reins and do things. And what happens when you do that as a manager sometimes, it's you're failing. You're failing because if you can't find the right pieces to the puzzle that are going to make that artist feel as safe as you feel, as you made them feel, then you're going to lose that artist. Yeah. And I lost you because if I had just stayed in your corner 100% throughout, I would have been in much better shape. And then even when Vincent left or whatever, however it was, if I had been in your life the way you wanted me to be in your life towards the end, instead of somebody who you felt like you were sort of somebody who was less significant than the other people, you would have been there. But what Judy and that company brought to you is they brought to you a feeling of safety. Hey, listen, you can start headlining around the improvs all over. We'll start you in, you'll build your audience, you'll go around. And they had 19 comedy clubs.
Yeah.
And so as a young father and you had a family and whatever, I could never provide that for you. And they provided that safety for you, and then they provided opportunities for you, and they've continued to stay in your life that way and not put you in a position where you were with a younger person or whatever. And I have a lot of respect for Judy. But Judy's one of those people, again, I will say this honestly on this podcast, she's the kind of person sometimes I feel like if I were on the road and she were in a truck, she'd run me over with the truck. Because I have done things in my career that are unusual, and I've done things a different way and taken a different path. And sometimes, you know, the way I've handled things and projects that she'd been involved in, because she was a casting director as well, are not the way that she would want business to be done. And I don't have, I've never had a relationship with Judy Brown where it's like lovey-dovey or whatever. But I hope she knows that I have an enormous amount of respect for her.
I think she does.
And that company is unbelievable, and I love what they do. And the greatest thing for me is to know that you are happy and you are doing well. I know that's kind of odd, because normally when you don't work or you break up with a girl or whatever it is, or a marriage ends, sometimes there's animosity or whatever. I have not one shred of animosity towards her or them or you. I want to do well.
I don't have
even the travel show that you're doing. If you could, if you know this or whatever, Bert worked on a project that was an independent project where he did sort of like his own thing, where he did a thing at the Queen Mary or whatever,
the Cinderella story,
and he put a DVD together and we worked on editing, and he did most all of the work, but I might put some tweaks on or whatever. The way I believe that the Travel Channel show, and this is how I have no absolute, and you might disagree with me, that executive at the time called me and asked me, is there anybody you know who can do this kind of show?
Yeah.
And I didn't have anybody on my roster that could do that kind of show, or even remotely was right for that kind of show. But I said to them, there's a guy, Bert Kreischer, you should look at. And he did some kind of a pilot or something regarding that. I think it was called Cinderella Story. And you were with Judy at the time. And he said, well, do you have anything on that? And I remember going through these boxes, these old boxes of mine. And I found an old VHS or DVD copy of Cinderella Story. And I sent it to this executive. And I gave them your information and Judy's information. And that's the last I heard of them or whatever. But the fact is, you still had to earn the gig.
No, yeah,
you still
had
to get the gig, and you still had to do whatever. But the point being is that it makes me happy that I've been a part of your life in some capacity, whether I'm 1% of your career or any percentage thereof. It makes me happy to know that you're doing well, and this podcast is amazing, too. And you've always been the kind of guy who was huggable, lovable, and you've also always been a guy who's been quietly self-destructive.
Quietly, very.
And that's one of the things that, if you want to talk about, that I believe is the thing that's going to be the difference of whether you're going to take things to the next step or not.
Yeah, I think that is a big difference in my life. And I think that is always something you kind of always tried to get me to acknowledge is drinking. I've always been a really big drinker. And I think the drinking has gotten me to definitely make a name for myself in the clubs. But I think also it's a part where you just start getting to a point where you're like, Jesus Christ, man, I'm fucking 41 years old. Like, I'm not a college kid anymore. But I want to talk about you. I want to talk about you. I don't want to talk about me. This is what I want to talk about.
Whatever you want, man. This is your show.
self-destructiveness part. We can fucking fill a boat, three podcasts with that. Now, this is the analogy I explained to someone. Everyone always says, I don't know who it was. Someone was like, I'm thinking about working with Barry. What do you think? This was very recently. I was like, fucking do it. And I said this analogy to him. You started out, and this is the analogy, as a professional surfer. You were a great surfer on the North Shore, but the truth was you never felt comfortable with a break that broke right, and doing that, you're never going to surf Pipeline, and if you don't win Pipeline, you're not going to make a name for yourself, and you realize that. But you could also realize what made other surfers better surfers, so you decided to manage. And you started coaching surfers, and in the process, started making surfboards for them and helping them make their own surfboards for themselves. And you were brilliant at that. You were fucking brilliant at that. When you were hungry, you would. I remember having this conversation with the Boston Comedy Club. You would spend all night, in this analogy, shaping fucking surfboards and taking a look at Louis C.K.'s surfboard and carving out the fine lines that maybe he didn't notice, okay? Then you started getting bigger, and you set up a shop for yourself, and you were selling your surfboards, and you still had a small team that was massively successful. And that's when New Wave stepped in, and you got bought out by O'Neill. And you were still shaping, but your real goal was to teach everyone else how to shape. And in that process, and I believe this, and I don't know what you think, but I feel like you probably went through what I think a lot of people, including myself, go through at this age in the business. You were probably like 45 at the time, and you were like, what is this about? Like, am I really a guy who just facilitates people getting famous? Or am I someone that can make things too? Like, I used to surf. I'm a waterman. Like, that's the way your brain worked. And you started making TV shows, and you were really fucking good at that. But I do believe that a lot of us young pro surfers were like, I want him to come out and paddle out with me and explain why the wave breaks the way it does. And you're like, quite honestly, I don't have that time, but Brian Volkweis can teach you how to do that. And I remember going like, Brian can barely fucking swim. Like, you're sending out me with a guy with water wings on, and you want me to learn how to surf from him? I remember, like, Brian answered the phones when we first started shaping surfboards, and you want him to teach me how to surf? What does he know about fucking comedy? I remember distinctly. And so at that point, I think a lot of young surfers were like, fuck it, I'm going to go find other breaks, and I hope the best for Barry. But at the time, it was just like, I remember the first day you walked me through New Wave, it was like walking through a huge company, and you were showing me all the shops, and all of that was like so unimportant to me, because all I wanted to do was talk about my next set, or like, you know, like whatever it was small in my world, because you always were this. Really, honestly, the thing you are best at is giving inspirational speeches and forming someone's set. You can get someone a 7-minute, you can help someone make a 5-minute Tonight Show set in your sleep. You can tell people what jokes are unimportant and not hurt their feelings, and tell them how to make a joke better. And you can tell them the confidence they need to get on that stage and do that set. And I believe you will always be able to. You can also go in to a room and set people up to have great meetings. That is the truth. But then you got involved in New Wave, and you had your fingers in so many pies. I mean, I don't know how many TV shows you had at one time. Probably like 12?
Like, yeah, I mean, something like that.
Yeah. And these are TV shows that need your attention, and you have huge clients, the biggest clients in the business. And then everything stopped. And now you're back to making surfboards. Like, you're back in a small shop on the North Shore shaping surfboards for people who love to surf. And that's what I believe is happening. Is that semi-accurate?
Well, I think it's a lot of it's accurate in the sense that, again, for your listeners, and is like, whenever you take a check, you lose control.
Yeah.
That's why all of you out there that are creating your own content, doing your own short films, making your own YouTube channels, it's amazing.
By the way, Brian Volkweis, I know you heard this. I love you, Brian. I'm just saying, at that time of my career, I wanted Barry's advice and maybe less of yours when it came to my stand-up. I'm sorry, Brian, if that sounded shitty to you. I love you, and I think you are doing big things at New Wave, but keep going.
Yeah, so it's so I think I forgot my train of thought there for a second.
I'm so, you off with the
You just mesmerized me there, and I just was I was lost. Where was I?
You were saying that people that have control of their own fears.
Oh, yeah, so you have control of your own thing. So it's like you take something like, let's say, like Vine. Okay, Vine is something that's been around for, I believe, 14 months. Maybe a year and a half at best. Okay? 6-second content. Mm-hmm. There are people who have no entertainment background. They have no business savvy. They have nothing but a dollar and a dream and an iPhone.
Yeah.
And they have millions of followers.
Ry Doon. I just had him on. He's a Boston kid.
Yeah.
I just had him on.
Ry Doon, Brittany Furlong, Clarity, whatever it is. They're out there and they're making it happen. With their brain, with their ideas, their content. There's people with YouTube channels like, you know, PewDiePie and, you know, and Grace Helbig, who are doing amazing things, controlling their own destiny. And those are the people that I have an enormous amount of respect for, because your audience, I bet 99.9999% of them have never put up a significant number of pieces of content that they've created up for people to see, because it's nerve-wracking and it's scary. Because what happens if America says they don't like it? What happens if I have 27 views?
Yeah.
What does that mean about me? I'd rather not know that. It's like not wanting to go to the doctor when you're feeling some pains around your body and saying, I don't want to go because I don't want to hear I have cancer.
Yeah, that is a really good analogy.
And so when I went to that company, you know, these people offered me something that I'd never been offered before. They offered me to finance my whole operation. They allowed me to hire whoever I wanted. I could produce whatever I wanted in-house. I didn't have to go to this place for editing, that place for color correction. And
at the time, I will say, you had the number one comic who knew how to make for himself.
Yes.
To this day.
Dane Cook.
Dane Cook works for Dane Cook, and he will put money behind Dane Cook. And if you tell Dane Cook, I want you to do a set in front of a bunch of jihadists, the rule is they'll kill you if you don't kill. Dane will go. He'll roll the dice on him, Dane.
He will roll the dice. And there's times you tell you, you know, we always talk about Chappelle, and, you know, people will always say things one way or the other about him. But I can tell you one thing about your whole audience out there, which will be another 99.9999 percentile of none of you listening would ever turn down $50 million because you believed in yourself.
No one.
And said, fuck it, I'm not going to go this way. I'm going to go the way that I believe in. Mm-hmm. That's what a genius and what a brilliant person he is. Another person would say, no, well, that's what a crazy person is. No, it's like Ayn Rand in The Fountainhead, the main character. Escapes me.
Howard Rourke.
You know, he had it all. But people said, hey, we're paying you. Could you change this and change this? Go fuck yourself. I'm going back to the quarry.
Yeah.
And so for me, I wasn't Howard Rourke. I took the check.
Were you Keating?
Maybe.
By the way, read The Fountainhead. This Fountainhead defines, it will define you, and you will find out who you are in life, and it will open your eyes up.
Yeah. So I took the check, and the owner of that company was amazing to me. He did everything for what I wanted to do, and he supported me. And for 8 years, that guy helped me do everything I wanted to do, and I owe a tremendous amount to him. And when I left,
but in return, you established New Wave Entertainment.
Well, No.
Their only reason any comic talks about New Wave Entertainment. New Wave Entertainment was a post-production house that did trailers. Like, no one knew who. I'll say this because one of my friends works there. It's like Big Boss. Big Boss is a great post-production house. One of the top post-production houses in the world. But no one knows of Big Boss's selling product. They do an amazing job at what they do. One of the guys who did my documentary works at Big Boss. And they're fucking out of this world. They produce. They make a great product for what they do. but no one looks at them as selling sitcoms. And that was what happened with New Wave Entertainment. And you put them into the Hollywood landscape. No questions asked. There's not one question asked. Now, I'm not saying you by yourself. You, Dane Cook, Jay Moore, Louis Anderson, Gary Goldman, Whitney Cummings, Bob, all the people that you work with, put them on the map.
Well, I thank you. I mean, I don't, I, that, you know, everybody has, you know, there's three sides to every story, but I appreciate that. But I think that that was the goal, to go there and, you know, you take a check, and my goal was to treat that company like it was a client, and to be in a situation to move them to the next level when no one, it was an underdog. It was, the company was enormously successful in these areas that were not in the public eye, because, you know, when you're doing the posters for Star Wars, George Lucas isn't going to say, hey, New Wave did my posters.
Yeah, exactly.
It's going to be like, we did the fucking posters. I don't know who you're talking about. Or if you're doing the trailers for, or the finishing for Warner Brothers, or for, you know, you're doing the behind the scenes for whatever, you know, huge movie, Lord of the Rings, or they don't want to know, they don't want anybody to know that you did it. It was a secretive kind of incredible A-plus operation.
Yeah.
And the things that we did were not secretive. They were in the, they were in the realm of things in the business, and that's what we did. And so, going back to your story, so when I, when I took that check, yes, you're right. I think that I lost, I, you lose a part of yourself in anything. When you're doing the sitcom that you're going to do, there's going to be people who are going to tell you that you have to do things a certain way over and over again. And you're going to push back on some, but you're going to compromise on others, because you're taking the check. The check pays the mortgage. The check pays the schools where you're at, pays for that nice dinner with your wife on your anniversary. And you want a style of life that you have because of it. And I'm proud that when I did leave New Wave, that it was where it was, and it was doing well, and I'm proud of the success they're having.
And they're doing great right now. Yeah, they're, I mean, yeah, I not only know this because I follow Brian on Facebook, but they produced Tom Segura's album on or comedy special on Netflix.
Yeah, and when I was there, we started an initiative of doing digital stuff and doing a lot of our specials. I think we'd done like, I think we'd done like 30 specials by the time I left there. But I, you know, it's like, and they're doing great work, and I want them to do great, and I want them to succeed.
Well, yeah, you're not someone, you've been stabbed in the back a lot, and you've had a lot of, and I say stabbed in the back, let me rephrase that, because that sounds weird, but you have been someone who's been screwed over before, but you don't have ill will against people, and you don't hold that in you, and I'm shocked, because, like, when I get wronged, I end up, I stew with it. Like, I don't ever talk shit about people, and I don't wish ill will on people, but I do, I feel hurt for a long time. I think it's because I'm sensitive. And, but you don't. You genuinely go, you, I really do believe you genuinely want people that you did work at the New Wave to just succeed and keep coming, keep.
I want them to do, I mean, because if they do well, I think that whatever the foundation was that we put together, together as a team with myself and their team, continues, and it's a, it can only be good for everybody, and there's enough for everybody. I don't want to, I sit across from you, and I'm embarrassed that I haven't spent more time with you since we stopped working. I'm, well, embarrassed that
your life got extremely complicated.
It did get complicated, but also I think that with you and I think that there were situations that I was sad about, and I don't take things personally, and it was nothing to do with business, but, you know, one of the things that I love so much, that meant so much to me with you, as crazy as it sounds, I'm going to share this with you because you probably don't even know this, and you'll probably edit this out of your podcast or whatever, but but one of the things I looked forward to every year was something that happened at a park in Hollywood with you and your kids. It was an annual birthday thing that you had for your kids.
Yeah.
And I always was there, and I always was invited to come, sometimes with my little ones or whatever. And then you invited me to come one year, and after you made the switch, and then you called me and you said, Barry, can I ask you a favor? And I said, yeah, what is it? Would you mind not coming to the birthday party?
Did I say that?
And I said, wow, I'll do anything you want me to do. What's up? And you said, well, my manager's coming to the birthday party, and if you come to the birthday party, I know they're going to feel
Jesus
uncomfortable.
Christ.
And so I'd prefer if you just do me a favor. I would love you to be there, but it'd probably make things easier for me if you didn't come.
Holy shit. I'm definitely not editing that out, but...
And so that was a moment in my life where I said, my God, it's like, again, it's like when you take the check. It's like when you sign with a new management company or a new agency, you don't want to make waves. You're doing everything to try to just make things the way they're supposed to be, and you're acquiescing to certain people's idiosyncrasies or what you perceive to be their idiosyncrasies, as opposed to just going and being your own person and your own man. And if they go along with it, great, and if they don't, then they're not your manager anymore, and there'll be another person that will be okay with me being there or whatever. So,
God, I mean, I have no real recollection of that, but I always go like, fucking, you could fill a boat with what I don't remember that I've done or said. Like, I look back, but yeah, I'm sorry I did that, because I, like, Leanne was kind of excited that you're coming here. She's like, I'm dynasty pictures of his boys. Like, and it was so funny.
Woman.
I said, Barry's coming by to Georgia and Isla. And they're like, wait, do we know Barry? I go, do you remember the beach parties we used to go to? And they're like, yeah. I go, remember the two beautiful boys with long hair? And they're like, yeah. I go, that's Barry. And they're like, oh my God. So yeah, you did have a very familial way of running your company for a long time, even well into New Wave. I mean, I remember going to the party. I mean, you remember your wedding. Was a fucking blast. I'll never forget me and John DiMaggio, and I want to say Bobcat, but I know Bobcat's sober. No, wasn't Bobcat. Me, John DiMaggio.
Nick Swartzen.
And was it Nick Swartzen? Yeah. Got high outside, smoked a joint, and then tried to sneak back into the wedding, and we climbed through the curtains, and we walked on stage when someone was giving a toast.
That's right.
We walked right on stage, and we were like, and then John DiMaggio grabbed the mic and started giving more of a toast, and then Bobcat goes, Bert, get up there. And then I got up there, and they started playing the recordings of your ex-wife's family's messages from Russia, and it was like the funnest fucking wedding. It was like, we had such a blast sitting in the back when you guys did the thing under the chuppah.
It was at the Casa Del Mar on the ocean, and we went out on the ocean, and there were so many things. But one of the things I learned from you, Bert, that night that I hadn't learned in my whole life is that, and this is, you'll love this, and hopefully your audience will get this. If you're at a wedding, the amount of alcohol somebody drinks is directly in correlation to the amount of clothing they loosen or take off by the end of the night. So Bert started off in this beautiful tuxedo, all put together. You could get in a hurricane, his hair wouldn't move. By the end, he literally has a bow tie and boxer shorts on and socks.
I had my tie around my head, and I remember you coming up to me going, I am glad you didn't have anything to drink at this wedding. I go, you kidding me? I'm fucking hammered. I'm him sitting next to Bobcat Goldthwait. I fucking had the best time at your wedding. I remember talking Russian to your ex-wife's family in the bathroom.
People were like...
Buddy Hackett.
People were fucking women, and it was like the craziest thing. I couldn't believe what was happening at my wedding.
Someone brought like 10 pre-rolled joints to your wedding, and all I know is that we tore through those motherfuckers. And then the best, and this is... And by the way, this is so amazing. I'm making sure it's not Long Beach. This is legend. This is legend. Buddy Hackett, the late Buddy Hackett was there. Buddy is someone you introduced me to, and I got on the set of Action, and I met Buddy there.
Buddy was just so good to me, and I met Buddy through Jeff Ross, and
Jeff,
and I became so friendly with Buddy.
And Buddy was a drinker until his last days.
Yes, and he was one of. A moment that you know, sometimes you don't know what you mean to people.
Yeah.
And for me, one of the things sitting across from you and you tell these stories of me, and I'm being honest with you, I sometimes forget what I mean to you or what I meant to you.
Oh, I think
and so,
wholeheartedly.
And
yeah.
So, because I don't really get it. And I didn't really understand what I meant to Buddy Hackett until the night he died, and I got the call from his wife, Sherry. Barry, Buddy passed away, and I said, oh, I'm so sorry, Sherry. And she said, come over.
Wow.
And I came over and I opened the door and it's just her.
Oh, wow.
And I believe one of her daughters is in the kitchen. And I'm hanging with her and the doorbell rings and she said, could you open the door? And it's Jeffrey Ross.
Yeah.
And we hang out for another half hour, an hour, and the doorbell rings again. And it's Jay Moore. And the three of us were there for like 4 hours until like 3 in the morning.
Yeah.
And it was just us. And that's when you realize, you know, you don't think that you could mean something to somebody who's like one of the greatest legendary. The guy did the first two HBO specials. He was making $175,000 a week in 1951 in Vegas. And this guy, your wife, his wife knew that these three people, I mean, he wasn't calling like Newhart or Norm Crosby or whatever, who were, he introduced Bob Newhart to his wife, but we were there.
Yeah.
And so that meant a lot. So when Buddy came to the wedding, it meant a lot until... until all hell broke loose.
Hold on one sec. Hold on one sec. I got to make sure. So, sorry, everybody. That was just a little pause. We checked our phones. Your wedding is maybe, I'll say, in what things I've witnessed, and I've witnessed a lot of insane shit, one of the most legendary things I've ever seen. So, Buddy Hackett goes up to give a speech. And now, mind you.
I just want to preface this, but what happened was is that the best man, who was a very dear friend of mine, Martin Fromer, who owned a thrift shop on Melrose, he was going up to give the speech, and Buddy Hackett walked up and sort of took over.
He grabbed the mic from him, because Martin was not... By the way, I think Martin started speaking, and it was kind of going nowhere, and Buddy grabbed the mic from him. And now Barry's ex-wife was a huge Beatles fan, correct?
Actually, what happened was, just so... I wanted to surprise people, and I found this replica Beatles band, which is very popular now in Vegas, called the Fab Four.
Yeah.
And they dress like the Beatles, they look like the Beatles, and they did the three styles of Beatles. They did the early Beatles, the Sgt. Pepper Beatles, and the Let It Be Beatles. And no one at the wedding knew that I had them. And they had a specific keyboard set up that was on there that was programmed to do certain things in Beatles situation, for because the Beatles didn't use a keyboard in the early Beatles, but they used it in the middle and the late phases of their career. And so I want you to tell the story, but the first thing Buddy did was he went up and he, you know, keep in mind this was a wedding where there were a lot of people from. Outside of the country, my ex is from the former Soviet Union. There were people from Australia where they moved to, and all over. And it was a formal wedding.
One side was all family, and literally the other side was comics.
Yeah, and it was a very, you know. And so Buddy goes up and he says, you know, something to the effect of like, you know, hey, it's nice of that female rabbi you got there.
Well, Buddy, during the moment where you guys go under the chuppah and step on the glass, Buddy was in the back roasting the rabbi. So, like, we were all in the back. Me, John DiMaggio, Bobcat are all sitting next to Buddy and Jeff Ross, and he is roasting the rabbi in the back, and we were on the fucking floor. I walked all the way on the beach for this? A fucking female rabbi? When did we get a female fucking literally lighting her on fire, and we were laughing hysterically. So
because she want my ex wanted to have a female rabbi, but the thing is, you should know about Jewish weddings.
The first thing Barry needs to do is stand up in this marriage and get a male rabbi. I mean, Buddy's in the back lighting it up, and then he gets on stage and says, first thing we need to do is get rid of that female rabbi, which does not...
And she's in the room.
And then it gets a laugh, and the laugh stops, and Buddy goes to say his next line, and he hears a humming.
He hears the humming, but just before you go, the thing was, if you're in a Jewish ceremony, what happens is the rabbi, regardless if they're female or not, they at least have to mention at one time about the ketubah. And the ketubah is a Jewish a marriage license that basically protects the woman in divorce and if things don't go right in the marriage. So it has to be mentioned that there is the possibility that in divorce or in something that doesn't go right, that the woman will be taken care of. But this woman mentioned it like 7 times in the thing. It kept, you know, every like 5 minutes it was like about divorce or getting, but you know, so that's what Buddy
Maybe she's a prophet.
Maybe she is a prophet.
Enough with the ketubah. I mean, Buddy is murdering on stage, but there's this humming in the background, and he's killing so hard that when he says, "Can someone turn this fucking keyboard off?" it gets a huge laugh, and then he goes, "I'm serious with the fucking keyboard." Bigger laugh, says a joke, and he goes, "God damn it, if you don't turn this fucking keyboard off, I'll turn it off for you." Huge laugh, and he takes his drink and he throws it on the keyboard, and I swear to you, now mind you, this is my narrative, this is the way I remember it, and I was drunk, but I swear to God, sparks shot up, you heard a and smoke came out of the keyboard, and it destroys to the point we think it's a fucking prop, and everyone is laughing hysterically. Buddy finishes, closes, ends strong, and Barry's night is sent into a fucking tailspin.
It's sent into a tailspin because the manager of the Fab Four takes me aside and tears me a new asshole. "You motherfucker, you ruined that keyboard. That's a special keyboard. Now you're only going to get the early Beatles all night long."
But it was so fucking funny that everyone...
So the whole wedding was, "I want to hold your hand for 7 hours." Michelle Maybelle for like a...
Oh my God.
But it was incredible.
It was one of the most memorable nights I'll ever have, because obviously it was led by Buddy Hackett, and I would not leave his side. I just sat next to him, and I'd met him, you know, like I said, on the set
Action.
And we sat, and I sat in his trailer all night drinking with him. He had this special concoction of like tequila, whiskey, and vodka that he liked to drink. And it was in his thing, and every time he always had a flask with him. Always had a flask with him. And you always took a shot with him. Even when I was sober, I'd do a shot with Buddy Hackett. But that wedding was fucking phenomenal. And then did you and I only ask you this, and I don't answer, because I don't
want answer
to
any question.
But like, did you go through you leave New Wave and you get a divorce pretty much at the same time?
I'm not actually divorced yet, I'm separated, but I am getting a divorce yet. It's interesting, and again, one of the things that I have a lot of respect for you is, like, look, Leanne's an amazing woman, and it takes a really, really amazing woman to keep the train on the tracks. Men are like furniture. You just push them from one side of the room. You know, we don't understand. We don't get it,
yeah.
You know, and we don't know as much. And look, I'm proud of my relationship with Suzanne. I mean, when you have something that goes, you know, 10, 15 years, and you have a beautiful family, and in any town, in any environment, I feel like it's like almost like the Whitney Show going 2 seasons. It's like, yeah, you want to go the distance when you watch the Super Bowl, and you say, "Hey, there's the Harbaugh parents rooting. Who are they rooting for? They've been together for 50 years or whatever." But the point is that I love Susanna. I still, believe it or not, we still live in the same house.
Really?
We still have a great relationship.
Are you guys still in the house that you were before?
Yeah, yeah.
Fucking great.
Yeah,
I fucking love
that place.
I remember very early on when you were like, when I moved out here, you're like, "You got to decide what kind of guy you are. I'm a beach guy."
Yeah, I love the ocean. And again, you always move. And, you know, I had a place in Marina Del Rey and I loved it. And, you know, I ended up selling that. You know, you end up moving from, just like, you know, you love this place and you'll end up moving to it. You know, your life takes you in different directions. But when I did leave there, I don't think it had anything to do with the relationship thing. It looks like it's correlated, but I don't think it is. I think that I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be, and going with the what you said with the clients and things and the surfboards or whatever. As Dr. Phil might say, you know, there's only one person that can play you. And so I'm responsible for every single thing, good and bad, that's happened in my life. And the reason why I don't hold any grudges or anybody, and I sit across from you, I don't hold any grudges, because I know what we did together, but what's the point? I know my part.
Yeah.
I know my part, and I know what the deal is, and if I'd have done things a certain way or whatever, and there's certain things where, yeah, you say, well, things aren't, you know, yeah, you walk down the street and a jet engine falls and hits you on the head. You don't have any part in that. Right. You know, if you're driving down the highway and somebody just swerves in a lane and kills you, you don't have any part in that.
There's an easy way to find that your part in that, though. But there's like someone like me will find out, well, if I hadn't gotten, if I hadn't slept in, then I wouldn't be walking to school late and the jet engine wouldn't hit me in the head. That's the way my brain works.
It could be, but
I always find my fault in everything, and I think to a fault I do that.
It could be, and sometimes you're, as a manager, you'll get a call from somebody who will let you go, and you'll, excuse me, you'll hang up the phone, and I'm embarrassed to say this, you'll be like, oh, I'm so relieved. I'm so relieved that this happened. And there's other times where I've resigned from working with people, and I've been, I felt sick to my stomach, and I don't know what that's about. But you know, in terms of control, I don't necessarily like to have the control when a relationship is ending. I like somebody else to really feel it or whatever. Bernie Brillstein used to have this great line, and I met with him for breakfast about 6 months before he dies, one of the greatest managers ever.
He managed all the people from SNL, including Lorne Michaels, John Belushi, Chris Farley, everyone.
And he said to me, he said, Barry, I'm going to give you some words of advice, which, believe it or not, I still haven't necessarily followed to a T. He said, if the flashing light is on your phone and it's a client who's on the other line, they're on hold, and there's a pit in your stomach, fire them. And I told him there, I said, Bernie, I said, you know, it's easy for you to say. You're in your 70s. You've accomplished a lot. You've banked up a lot of assets. And you can do that. But for me, I perceive myself, even though other people might think differently of me, I feel like I've never accomplished what I want to accomplish, and I never have gotten where I want to go. And I'm always setting my sights higher and higher. And so if I did hang up the phone with those select people who I felt the pit in my stomach throughout the years, that would be self-destructive for me.
Yeah.
But in turn, you should just listen to your instincts as an artist and as a manager, because that's the only way you're going to grow. Now, for you and myself, I never felt the pit in my stomach. And that's one of the things.
I always felt when I called that the pit was in your stomach. I think that's, and that's the main reason I left, was that I couldn't get you on the phone, and I couldn't get your attention, and I couldn't get you to focus. And there were like two or three instances. Oh, Grandma Gardner's here. I'm good. How you doing? Yeah. And I felt like you were not getting the nuances of my personality, and like the things that were making me I felt like you thought should no longer happen to be me. And I was like, no, but like, and so I think that's when I just was like, I was like, you know what? I was definitely, and I'm always afraid of change. I'm also massively afraid of confrontation. I hate confrontation. But I think that leaving you, honestly, was the best thing I've done in my career, because it made me responsible for me. I was so dependent on you to take care of me, that I was like, I'd call you. I go, what am I going to do for money? Do you remember me calling you when I had Georgia? And I didn't have any fucking money. And I ran out all my money, and I didn't have any road work. And I was like, I need money. I'm having a kid. I'm broke. I owe money to the IRS, and I'm broke. And that guy, I didn't respect. Me calling you going, I need money. What do I do? Like, I'm a fucking grown man, and here I am. I'm about to have a child, and I'm calling a guy going, can you get me money? Like, And I think I've changed a great deal as a man. I still have a lot of fucking growth to do. I'm still a fucking hot mess in so many fucking respects. But I think that was, you know, for me, that was, which is, by the way, one of the more interesting things about Barry. You have had the biggest names in comedy and been fired by the biggest names in comedy. Dane Cook, which, by the way, fucking blew. Were you shocked when he fired you?
No, I wasn't shocked at all.
I was blown away.
But I wasn't shocked because I know the circumstances. And again, those were circumstances that happened that actually did not involve me directly. But I was a part of it, and I felt bad for him because he wasn't feeling comfortable, and you know, I probably, if I wasn't at New Wave at that time, we'd probably still be together. But there were a lot of issues that were going on that, but, you know, I still talked to him. I saw him the other night at the Boa, and I've been to his house, and he just reached out to me the other day. And
he seems really happy.
Yeah, I mean, it's the thing is that it nothing shocks me. I mean, I think the one that probably shocked me the most in my life was probably, you know, Tracy Morgan, because you're at the Boston Comedy Club. We used to have these roasts, and they used to roast me, and all the comics used to go up, and just Jeff Ross would host, and they'd all just, you know, do their thing and practice their roasting skills. And
yeah.
And Tracy walked in, and, you know, he'd just gotten on Saturday Night Live, I think a year earlier or something. And after he'd been living in the projects and had four kids and was, you know, really in danger and on welfare. And he didn't understand the concept of a roast. So he went on, and he walked up, and he was sort of crying and saying, "You guys are all assholes. How dare you shit on this guy? This guy took me out of the projects and put me in a nice place in a high-rise. My kids are having a great education, and you guys should have a little respect and get yourself a Jew white manager." And then he walked off, misty-eyed, off into the streets of Greenwich Village. And then 4 days later, I got a phone call from him saying, "Listen, this isn't working out."
What would surprise you more, getting a call from Dane to represent you again or Dave Chappelle to represent you again?
What would surprise me the most? That's a great question. It would probably surprise me more if Dave Chappelle called me, only because he's, you know, lived an existence that has been outside of the game.
Yeah.
So Dave lives his life in existence not playing the game. And so, technically speaking, because I function as a manager / producer of television and film, I'm technically part of the system and playing the game.
Yeah.
Whereas he's, you know, in a system where, this is what's crazy for you and your audience. Everybody's like, we got to do social networking. We got to do podcasts. We got to tweet. We got to get our Facebook page ready. We got to get it all together and work it all.
Yeah.
Dave Chappelle doesn't have a fucking website. Dave Chappelle probably never tweeted in his life. Dave Chappelle could give a shit. Yet Dave Chappelle could make a phone call to a Houston radio station right now and say,
sell,
you know,
a fucking theater.
I'm going to be doing this 5,000 seat theater tonight. We only have tickets on sale for another 4 hours, and it'd be sold out, and they'd be adding a second show.
Yeah.
So the fact is that it doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter when it comes to those things.
Yeah.
And that's when so Chappelle is working in that world where he doesn't need anybody. Yes, if he had a manager and if he had an agent that he really trusted who did film and television and he really worked hard at creating and putting things out there and that's what he wanted, yes, of course I could help him. I managed him for 8 years. I don't think anybody else managed him for more than a year.
Yeah.
What we accomplished together was insane. I mean, we had seven development deals in 8 years. He did $400 million movies. I mean, I know what we did.
Yeah.
I know what I can do with people, but I think Dane is still working in the system. He has an agency. He still wants to get film roles. He still wants to develop his television shows. He still wants to tour in a relevant way. He still wants to make his impact with content as an artist. Dane Cook still cares what people think about him and his craft. Dave Chappelle doesn't give a shit what anybody thinks. All he cares about is what the guy upstairs thinks and what he thinks.
Yeah.
And that's it. And, you know, he's living in Ohio on a farm or wherever it is with his family. He doesn't care. All he cares about is just doing what satisfies him and what helps his family, and that's all. So Dave would be the one that I would be surprised at. However, I will say this, is that people always play the game, name a musical artist, and tell me if he's a genius or not, or she's a genius or not. Dave Chappelle from the moment I met him, like you. I met him without knowing him that well. He was 18 years old, and I wanted to represent him, and I knew that he would do something just like I knew you would. As a matter of fact, when I sat down to lunch with Dave at Real Food Daily about a year ago, my ass just hits the seat, and he says, "Do you know what month it is right now?" I said, "I know what month it is." He said, "But you know what the significance is." I said, "No, I don't think I do." He says, "20 years ago today that you met me."
Really?
20 years ago this month that you met me. I said, he said, "Do you remember where you met me and what you said to me?" I said, "I remember it like yesterday. You were about 17 years old. Jason Steinberg, who was the manager of the club at the time, told me to come back on a Tuesday. You'd performed on a Monday and to see you. And I met you before the show started at the Boston Comedy Club in the main part of the club. And I shook your hand and I looked at you and I said, 'Listen, I want to represent you. I think you're going to be one of the biggest stars in comedy and film. And you're going to change the face of comedy.' And you were gracious and you said, 'You know, Barry, you know, what are you talking about? You've never even seen me perform. You haven't seen a videotape. You don't know me.' And then I said, 'You know, well, shaking your hand, it's like the dead zone. I can see the future, and that's what I see.'" And at that table, you know when you're at a place, and again, maybe I'm exaggerating. I don't think I am because of the way I remember them. You know,
by the way, thank you, because that's my entire life story. I think I'm exaggerating, but this is the way I fucking remember it.
Yeah. You know when somebody slaps a table so hard that the dishes shake and the silverware shakes in a restaurant and people are sort of looking at, like, what's happening? And he slaps the table and he's like, and he gets into that Dave that's not angry Dave, but, like, you know, forcefully. He's like, "That's right. That's right. And it haunts me every time I think about it." And literally, I sit back in my chair and I'm like, "Dave, I just sat down. I just wanted to talk to you." It was just, and then he got into solemn Dave, and he's like, "I'm sorry, man. Just every time I think about that moment, I just say to myself, how the fuck did he know?"
And so
that's the thing that I happens to be sometimes yeah. like that. And so with Dave, I know what I did, and I know his talent, what he did. And with Dane, I know what I did, and I know what he did with his talent. You talked about talent betting on themselves. This is a guy that in the beginning had $25,000 in the bank from college gigs, and he said, "Barry, I want to build a website," in 2000. And I'm like, "A web what?"
That's back before anyone fucking
He's like,
had
"I want to build a website." I said, "I don't see what you mean." Actually, I normally am a visionary. Here I was, and he said, "Listen, Barry, I need to build a great website, and you need to help me do this."
And his website.
And I said, "Well, what do you need me to do?" He said, "I need you to talk to this guy from the U.S. Army. That's the best website out there. Whoever designed the U.S. Army website." I said, "We're doing comedy here, Dane. What do you think?" "Barry, find the guy, negotiate the deal." I call the guy, toughest negotiation I ever had in my life. The guy wouldn't budge on anything. I fought with the guy forever. He wanted $25,000 for a website with all these pages the way Dane wanted, and I finally might have gotten three more pages out of him for nothing. And Dane launched this website that basically fucking the Rolling Stones didn't have a website like this. Nobody had a website, and this changed the face of everything. And he's put content up, he put things up, and he would answer every email he got. The first 15,000 emails he got, he answered personally, and it started going. And, you know, again, I probably, you know, for myself, for my podcast, people say, "Well, how are you up there in, like, the top 50 or...
Yeah.
Podcasts, and how did you launch at number three? Nobody knows you. Nobody knows the people you're talking to." And to be honest with you, it's an anomaly to me because I can do it for somebody else. Like, you could say to me, you could sit across from me and say, "Barry, could you help me do this, 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 and this, and this?" And I would make it happen for you. But for myself, I couldn't social network to save my life. And so these things are happening basically because people like you are saying to somebody else, listen, you should listen to that, and then somebody
I've talked about your podcast on this podcast plenty of times because it is a great podcast.
And so it's because of you and the word of mouth. It's not because of my...
I smell in the Barry Katz future a lecture series at colleges. Why not? Can I tell you what podcast I'd like to hear you do? I would like to hear you talk to the guy who wrote Save the Cat. I'd like to hear you talk about a screenplay and how to write a screenplay and sell a screenplay. I want to hear how to write a treatment. You should be what you're doing is valuable. And I wouldn't be shocked if you did a college tour. I know you know how to book those. And talked to young people that want to get in the industry about the different avenues to get into the industry, the different opportunities. I'd pay money to see that, Barry. I would pay money to see that.
Well, this is one of the toughest things, because you do something like this, and I do it, and I come on things like this because I want to make a difference to people. I really do.
Yeah.
I don't, and there have been offers to do things like you're talking about. There's been offers to do. I've had television people talking about doing things. I've had theatrical plays, digital theatrical plays, where you have a panel of people to do things, and I just feel like I don't want to get away from what I am, but
which
I
is
also
a surfboard shaper.
But I also don't want to get away from doing something that helps people.
Yeah, well, I think I'll tell you what. And I said this to whoever, and I remembered who it was, but and I'll tell you later. But whoever it was, and I was like, I think in your career right now, Barry could do nothing but amazing stuff for you, as soon as I found out you were putting up your own shingle and by yourself, I think that's the right term, but by yourself again, I was like, ooh, this is going to be an interesting chapter. This is going to be the fucking chapter where you're like, shut the fuck up. They didn't kill him all the way. He lives. You mean he's coming back into the village? Oh, people have shit to pay for.
Well, I don't know about that, but I had my own thing. This is the weird part. You know, I had my own thing. For those of you who don't know, I had my own company beforehand, and I was always like, for like 15 years, and I was always thinking to myself, okay, let's get a comedy club going. Let's get a personal appearance thing going. Let's do this. Let's do that. Let's hire 10 people. Let's open up an office in L.A. And I was always doing that stuff, and I feel like, in a way, it's like a selfish move, slightly, doing my own thing. And even when I got in my new office, which is, you know, I love where I am in Century City, and it's incredible place. I literally, the first night I was there, I stayed late, and I was walking around, and I was thinking to myself, God, okay, let's see. If I hire this one, I could put them there, and if I could take over that office there, and that. And I literally stopped in the middle of my sentence in my head and said to myself, shut the fuck up. Be your own guy. Don't worry about anything else. Have a better life for you and the people who believe in you, and just don't complicate winning.
Yeah.
And just do your thing. And I could have worked out of my, just like you said, you know, you're doing your podcast out of your man cave. I could have in my house, I have this whole, you know, like 1,000 square foot or whatever it is, office space that's all hooked up with phones that no one would even know where I was or how, whatever. And I know I could have done that, but I didn't want to do that. I just wanted to have my own space. It was really nice. And if I was going to invite a network president to my office to do a podcast, and we're going to sit down for 90 minutes, I want them to feel like comfortable and feel like, again, it's part of their world and part of what it is.
Yeah.
But I don't know how much more time we have, but I want to...
I've got a meeting at 12:15.
So how much more time do we have? 1 minute, 5 minutes?
1 minute.
1 minute.
Yeah, what would you say to someone in 1 minute, Barry?
Well, this is what I want to say in 1 minute. I want everybody to know this, is that Bert Kreischer is an example of somebody when he was starting who created a fucking problem. He went in situations when no one expected him to, and he won. He beat the system. He beat the system because he prepared harder than everybody else. He didn't have a sense of entitlement. He studied people. And this is what Bert did that he didn't realize that he did. He studied greatness. He imitated greatness. And he became great.
That's a fucking and, well worth that minute.
And that's what he did. Now, throughout his career, there's been times where he would readily admit to you that he didn't do that. Maybe drank a little too much. Maybe partied a little too much. Maybe thought a little too much about certain people. Maybe talked shit about certain people. Maybe hung out at the improv a little too long. Maybe didn't create enough content.
Yeah.
But the fact is that he rode that out, and now he's doing his own show, which is very difficult to do, and you have to go in the rooms, and you have to win. And again, you have to get that development deal, but it's like the NFL playoffs, what he's doing right now. Yeah, he won the wild card game. He's got a television deal. And now he's got to get a pilot going. He's got to get a pilot going. And to do that, he's got to do a script and get a script that's approved. If he gets the script that's approved, hey, guess what? He won the conference game.
Yeah.
Okay? Then if he gets the order for the pilot, hey, guess what? He won the championship game. But now he's got to get the pickup to series, okay? And if he gets the pickup to the series and gets on the air, he's won the Super Bowl. And the only way he's going to win another Super Bowl is if America says, that's my fucking guy. I'm going to tell everybody to watch that show. Similarly to people say, listen to your podcast or mine.
Well,
and that's what you're doing, and that's what every artist listening or anybody who listens to your podcast, wherever you are, should know, is that you can do it and you can beat other people who are more qualified than you. And if you do the right things and you study and figure out how to be better and work harder than everybody else, you can make it happen. And that's what you've done. And I'm very, very proud of you, and I'm honored that you had me on the podcast. I'm very grateful.
Well, if you want to listen to a Super Bowl winner talk to other Super Bowl winners, go to Industry Standard. It is Barry's podcast. It is fascinating. If you are a college kid and you want to come out to L.A. and you want to have dreams, this is the podcast that will steer you. This is your self-help podcast. It is fantastic, Barry. It is an honor to talk to you again. I miss you immensely. You are such a fucking insightful, great guy, and you have had such a role in everything I have in my life and where I am today. I could not thank you enough. I only hope that we can keep in touch and maybe have you back on the podcast and do it again.
Oh, I'd love that, and I love you, and I thank you so much, and you've had a huge impact on my life and my career too.
What a great way to end. I love you, Barry.
Love you too, man.
This episode was brought to you by The Machine.